Welcome back to the ADHD Month podcast, and today we are talking about advanced ADHD myths. We are busting through these myths, and this episode, yes, you can send to family, friends, and skeptics, people that are important to you that may or may not believe some of these myths. I'm going to make sure I've added in as much research and science as I can to ensure that you won't receive responses like, that's just some woman influencer online. What qualifications does she have? Oh no, that's just one person's opinion. Yes, great point. It's always good to critically think about the information that you're getting. This is why I'm going to add in references to everything before we jump into the myths. Okay, so today's episode is going to be a little bit spicy. This episode is fairly advanced. It's going to be for some of you who have been in this space for a while. Maybe you've listened to every single episode. Maybe you're already diagnosed. Maybe you've read all the articles. You've listened to all the content. But you're still bumping up against false beliefs, cultural pressure, internalized shame that you didn't realize was even there. Or maybe you've already busted through the surface level myths and you just want more. You want to hear the ones that people still believe. I think we've moved past ADHD isn't just for boys. It's not just about being physically hyper. We are past that at ADHD Mums. We are moving into more advanced content because you can find those myths anywhere. Let's go to some really hot ones that I see that people still believe that I think need to be busted. First one, if you are high functioning, you cannot be neurodivergent. Or if you are high functioning, it can't be ADHD. You can't be autistic. You must be fine because you're high functioning. Now, firstly, what is high functioning? So when we talk about high functioning, we throw the words around, but sometimes I wonder if we really know what it means. High functioning is problematic because it's a descriptive term. It isn't a clinical diagnosis. A clinician is not going to say you are high functioning or low functioning. It is not a diagnosis. It's a description. It's often used to describe somebody who appears to be coping fairly well on the outside. They could be holding down a job. They could be raising kids. They could be married. They could be running a business. They could be managing all of those daily tasks. And they could have ADHD or they could be autistic. They could have a neurodivergent profile. The key here is that high functioning often just means high masking. Now, I also don't want to take for granted that everybody knows what high masking means. Again, we throw it around. Do we know what it means? High masking is one of the most misunderstood but crucial concepts in the neurodivergent experience. High masking is a conscious or an unconscious effort to suppress or hide your neurodivergent traits to appear normal, air quoting, socially acceptable, or competent in a neurotypical world. Now, this isn't faking it till you making it. It's a survival conditioning. What does it look like? High masking looks like suppressing stimming behavior. So suppressing those things, suppressing movement, for example, or fidgeting, things that make you feel better or calmer but aren't socially acceptable. Over preparing for social situations, writing a script before you arrive or make a phone call. Mimicking body language from other people, scripting a conversation, people pleasing, hiding overwhelm, pretending to have it all together, you're going awesome when really you are really struggling to arrive on time, for example. But maybe you walk in all calm and relaxed as if it all just happened so easily. But really, high functioning and high masking is like another form of invisibility. It's functioning in a neurotypical world that wasn't built for you, so you just pull it off in a way that no one sees that cost. But when you're pulling it off in a way that no one can see the cost, you also then cop, you're not ADHD enough. You seem fine. So you are surviving in a way that then kind of comes back to bite you in a way. Now, this high masking profile to be high functioning is quite harmful because it has a really enormous emotional effort. It can lead to identity confusion, like who am I if I'm not productive or if I'm not performing? You can have chronic exhaustion, anxiety, depression, and it also can delay diagnosis, especially in women and girls. Or it can also make support harder because you come across fine in air quoting. So for example, if you're a little bit confused as to what this means, you might appear organized and capable at school drop-off, but you may completely forget to feed yourself until 2 p.m. You might always be the one to remember the birthdays, the RSVPs, but you're also burning out inside your head because it's all in your head, but people think it comes easily. So high masking and high functioning is not a strength. It's a survival, and it's managing at the cost of your nervous system. The goal isn't to mask better. The goal isn't to be high functioning, okay? That's not the goal. So if we go back to the myth that I was talking about from the beginning, if you are high functioning, you can't have ADHD. You can't be autistic. That is why, because the high functioning, high masking description to describe a lot of women and mums actually makes it really difficult to one, get diagnosed and two, seek help. And you can cop from a medical professional, wow, well, you've been fine for 40 years. Why would you need help now? And that has been part of the problem with the NDIS, which I will not talk about the NDIS because that will lead me down a different path. So high masking is a description of how well someone masks their distress. You could run a business, you can raise three kids, you can work in your own business, you can manage a lot of different things, you can be studying, you can be highly successful. However, you can also then be on the burnout or the verge of burnout 24/7, all the time, for 10, 20 years. And people who are on the edge of burnout, right when they are in crisis, they may take their foot off the accelerator just for a moment, take a small breath for like half a day, and then they're like back on for the next 10 years. So these people operate at a very high level, and it can be difficult to then, when you're explaining to somebody that you're struggling or you've been diagnosed or you need help, when they're like, but you're going better than me. And it's not a comparison thing. It may just be a friendship thing. Like if someone is telling you that they have ADHD or they're autistic and this is what they're going through, but yet they're the person that you ask for the information for school or you look up to or you ask them for help and they're telling you that they're struggling and that they have ADHD, you may take a personal point of view on that and be like, but if you're saying that about you, what does that mean for me? One of the metaphors that I like to use about it is like a duck paddling underwater really, really, really fast with their legs. Let's say we have two ducks that are swimming at the same speed and we have one duck that is frantically swimming underneath the water, but nobody can see it. It looks like they're just gliding through. We have the other duck who's swimming at the same speed, but they're not really trying that hard. They're just kind of like coasting through, all sweet, and then maybe they're at the same pace. Maybe then, if you are the duck that's really, really, really exhausted, that's been swimming a lot under the surface, you may say to the other duck, hey, I'm actually exhausted. This is taking all of my energy. I can't cope. But the other duck's like, but we were swimming at the same speed. You're the same as me. I'm fine. Or even you're swimming faster than me. You're always ahead of me. What could possibly be the problem? So you can see here that the label of being high functioning or the description of being high functioning really doesn't mean anything in terms of being ADHD or autistic or struggling mentally at all. Now, these functioning labels really ignore internal suffering. So the functioning label looks like you are high functioning or you're low functioning, but it doesn't show the internal suffering. And one of the areas that I'm most passionate about is if we flip this into a myth around children. So if you have a high functioning child who appears fine at school, and that's an air quoting on fine, what you may find with them is that they have a lot of internal suffering. They have a lot of internal anxiety. For them to be high functioning at school has a huge internal cost. Now, when we think about mental health crisis, we think about teenagers and tweens and self-harm, addiction, alcohol, drugs. What we can see is that we can see there is a higher correlation of that with neurodivergent children and teens. There's so many different reasons, and I'm not going to go into all of it because that'll be a whole other episode. But what I am saying is that if you have a child that is coming across air quoting fine at school, that doesn't mean they are fine. That could mean there's a huge amount of internal suffering. And if that's the case, I would argue, are they really high functioning? Probably not, because high functioning may come at that cost. You may have two children that are actually very similar in the way that they present. And every presentation is different, of course. But let's say we have two that are similar. But we have one, and society expectation on girls means that this is often more likely to be a girl, but it can absolutely be boys as well, where they will be that person, they will be that good girl at a cost. You may have, and it typically, this is just a gender stereotype, I understand that, boys are less affected by that society expectation. So they may be more disruptive. They may be more like medium functioning, like they're not really trying as hard. The same level of internal suffering may not be there. So when we're looking at two kids in a classroom, who receives the help? The one who is more outward. And then who gets diagnosed? The one who's more outward. Who doesn't necessarily get that diagnosis, or maybe their parent has to fight for it? The one who is more high functioning, internalizing, high masking. Often, not always, those are girls. And if you have a son that does this, it's similar. Because sometimes that can make it harder for them too, because boys usually present differently to girls. So sometimes now professionals are across, girls present differently. But if you have a boy that's presenting differently, that can be difficult to get that diagnosis and that help. So when we're talking about high functioning labels, and I'm air quoting, it's more of a description of how well someone masks their distress. And the goal is not to be high functioning. The goal is to adapt to your environment in a way that you can actually sustain it long term without burning out. So I know that was a very long first myth, but that was a real passion area for me. So I suppose a couple of key things for me on this point. The better you have become at performing to neurotypical expectations, the more invisible your needs become to others and yourself, and the less likely you are to receive help, support and diagnosis. That is not something to aspire to, ADHD mums, women, and for our daughters. That is part of the problem. So myth number one, if you are high functioning, you can be ADHD, you can be autistic. It just means that you are performing to that level at a cost, and that is a learnt behavior that you have done for a long, long time. Now, there is some research here from Hull in 2020. I'm going to put that into the show notes, and it shows that camouflaging and strategies in ADHD and autistic women are linked to delayed diagnosis and higher rates of anxiety and depression. That is there in the research. I will add that to the show notes. So myth number two, ADHD equals executive dysfunction. End of story. Okay, obviously that's not true. We know that ADHD does affect executive function, of course. However, this is what gets missed. It's not just about getting stuff done. It's about emotional regulation, time perception, working memory, perfectionism, guilt, difficulty switching between tasks, even when we want to. There are so many areas of life that ADHD affects, and it's different for everybody. One of the other ways that ADHD affects women, particularly in mums, is because many ADHD mums feel a deep shame, not because they don't care, but because they care so much. Doing things right, air quoting, being seen as capable, not letting my kids down, a great mum, because you are so concerned that someone might find out that you are struggling, is a part of the ADHD. So it's not just an executive function disorder. If you have actually got decent executive function, you may have, that does not mean that you don't have ADHD. Now, I'm going to put again into the show notes, there is a model from Dr. Thomas Brown, and it highlights that motivation is biologically compromised. Okay, so this is not a, you just need to try harder, you need to get more motivated, buy a new planner. You are biologically compromised in terms of motivation and time management. I'm going to put that into the show notes as well. Myth number three, medication fixes everything. So when I was first diagnosed with ADHD, I was really hell-bent on getting medication straight away. Because a lot of us have been searching for that answer for a long time. We're like, why is it so hard? And when we get that, maybe someone talked to us, a practitioner, a friend, we saw it online, that we may have ADHD. It's like, oh my God. And there's a fix and there's a medication. And it's like this new shiny object that you're just going to be better overnight. And I was like, get me the meds. That's how I felt. I was so excited. However, if you have been medicated for ADHD, you may know that it doesn't fix everything. And medication doesn't help everybody. It's not available to everybody. Some people have got chronic health conditions. They can't take it. There's so many things. So not everybody takes medication. Not everybody wants to. And some people take medication, cannot find the right one. Now, I have been lucky to find a medication that helps me. I love my ADHD medication. But does it fix everything? No, it doesn't. And to think that it will, and that all you need to do is take a pill, God, I wish that was true, but it is not. Medication is just part of the toolbox. So if you go take medication and then people say to you, well, why are you still running late? Why is your phone flat? Why aren't you doing this? What's happening? It's a myth. Medication will not fix everything. You will not then just suddenly be this magical unicorn person who is just killing it in all areas. The medication does not teach you how to build a sustainable life. You need to unlearn the internalized productivity culture, perfectionism, the coping skills, the high functioning, the high masking, all of the things. In fact, some medications can actually make things worse. If you have anxiety, you have burnout, you have PMDD, medication can actually take you a few steps back to begin with, at least. One of the most under-talked about skills for ADHD women is nervous system regulation, okay? And taking a stimulant medication which affects your nervous system does not mean you are going to be magically fixed. We need to look at our nervous system. We need to look at our lifestyle. We need to look at everything. A lot of ADHD traits in women mimic anxiety and trauma. So medication is great, but it is usually the first step or one of a step in your path. It is not the be all or end all. Myth number four, autistic kids are easy to spot. I could recognize an autistic kid at a birthday party. I know what they look like. If my child was autistic, I would know. Or, you know, a teacher saying, your kid doesn't look autistic. I mean, that one really hurts, doesn't it? And I think this one also really hurts our girls and it hurts us. There is opinion around that I've heard from many psychologists, and they talk about how if a young girl, and look, it can be a boy as well. I'm just going to talk girls for a moment. If a young girl is attractive, let's say sporty, smart, that is just going to reduce the likelihood of that child getting diagnosed. And it could be a boy or a girl. So autistic kids do not have a look necessarily. You wouldn't necessarily be able to tell. I think that's quite, it actually makes me feel really awful to even say those words out loud, let alone on a podcast, because it's so offensive. But there are people out there that will still talk about a child looking autistic or not. And my message would be, one, that's offensive, incredibly offensive, and two, it's untrue. What we do know is that autism is not always flapping hands. It's not avoiding eye contact. All of those are myths. It can be scripted play. So you've learned from TV what to say or do. You've learned from the other kids, the popular kids, what to do or say. Maybe you say jokes that other people have laughed at. You repeat them because you think that's the recipe for making people laugh. Perfectionism, people-pleasing, deep interest in emotional justice, social justice, extreme fatigue from masking. It might look like stomach aches, anxiety, headaches. Every autistic person is slightly different. So it's really difficult to even talk about how one might look or present because it's going to be different for everybody. One thing I will say, though, is that the most well-behaved child who is autistic may be experiencing the most intense internal distress because what is that costing them? So it is a myth to say that you can pick out an autistic child in a crowd, and it's a myth to say that you would be able to tell because they couldn't follow a rule, for example. That is completely untrue. What we do know from the research, and I'll put this into the show notes, is that autistic girls are often misdiagnosed with anxiety, OCD, eating disorders, before autism is even considered. And that came from Lai and Baron Cohen, 2015. It will be in the show notes. Now, if your child is coming home from school and collapsing emotionally, I think you really need to consider masking, which I talked about earlier. That's not a bad day. That's exhaustion from social performance, okay? Social performance means that these children are not getting picked out in a crowd, and it's also at an intense internal cost. Myth number five. The goal for ADHD mums is to catch up on life and then just move ahead and be normal. Now, we don't say it out loud a lot, but I notice in the Facebook group particularly that a lot of people will say things like, I just need to get on top of things. If only I could get organized. I just need some meds to get on top. And then I'm just going to be okay. Now, for ADHD and autistic people, you have a neurological difference. The goal is not to normalize yourself. The goal is to set up environments and accommodate for yourself and redesign your life. Now, this isn't about you desperately taking ADHD medication, trying lots of strategies to then see if you can then pass as neurotypical. That is not the goal. Our goal is not to catch up. Our goal is to build a life around your brain. That at its core is what ADHD Mums is about. It's about rebuilding your life around your brain. It is not about catching up with everybody else, comparing ourselves, and then feeling like we might closely resemble someone that we've looked up to that is completely different to us and probably is really unhappy internally, but they just don't show it. Now, you might say, oh, how do I rebuild a life around my brain? That sounds super complicated. Okay, firstly, I'm actually bringing out some big guides around this year. But when we're talking about rebuilding life around your brain, what we're talking about is outsourcing without guilt, asking for support, getting help with your kids, lowering the bar, but permanently. Not like lowering the bar today because I've been up all night with my kids, lowering the bar permanently. Asking for support before you collapse, allowing yourself to feel things. Stop fake smiling and pretending to be happy if you are not. Now, the research shows us that long-term success from neurodivergent adults does not come from fixing symptoms or fixing traits. It comes from shifting your whole system. And that comes from Dvorsky from 2016. That research will be in the show notes. So that is, the long-term success of neurodivergent adults does not come from fixing ADHD traits or autistic traits. It comes from shifting the systems within yourself. So that there, I really want ADHD mums to get. This is not about keeping up with others, comparing, or looking at your children and then finding ways so we can keep up with the neurotypical families around us. What we are doing is we are modeling how to build a life around your brain. And that's fundamentally what I want my children to be able to do, to pick jobs, partnerships, places to live. Set your life up around your brain so you have set up the strengths. I reckon there's a heap of undiagnosed adults who are not planning on getting diagnosed because they're happy. So people that get diagnosed aren't people that are going great, are they? Because they're not the people that sign themselves up for an assessment or go to therapy, or like, they're not in those spaces. And if you are happy and you are neurodivergent, there is absolutely no reason to get diagnosed. So I wouldn't go around to a really happy family member, for example, and just let them know that they're neurodivergent, because they may have set up their life to build around their brain. They have maybe set up a business around something that they love, a massive passion. So the goal is not to catch up and be normal. The goal is to build a life around your brain. Myth number 6, neuroaffirming means that you don't correct, you don't challenge a child. They are perfect the way they are. You just let them be. You don't do any corrections or challenging because they're perfect and we're just going to just allow them, and everyone has to just move around them because they are perfect. Now, I don't like that growing trend in parenting in the neurodiverse space that suggests that. And I don't love it when that's the assumption from others. So for example, I don't love it when, let's say, a fellow podcaster or an article comes out online and it says, neuroaffirming people believe that their child is just different and that everybody needs to accommodate them and the environment needs to change and it's not them, it's just the world, and they need to be allowed to be who they are. That, I don't believe, is fundamentally true. That is not what neuroaffirming is. That is what I think some people think it is, but that is not what it is. And I think the growing trend is that people think that if you are neuroaffirming, you don't correct a child, you don't help a child, you don't show them a better, easier way to move forward. And the difference is that, for example, I heard someone say the other day that they didn't believe that a neurodiverse child should do speech pathology. This is a good example. because they don't believe that an autistic child should learn proper speech from a speech pathologist. If they want to talk in a specific way, they can. I get it, because I think from a neuroaffirming point of view and a lived experience autistic and ADHD person point of view, there are so many people out there that are so over masking. They're so over being shoved into these neurotypical molds and then like kind of forced to comply. Like, go into this noisy environment, even though you're sensory sensitive. Go and do this, even though it's really difficult for you. Push down your feelings and go ahead and do it. Yeah, I get that. I get that completely and I agree. But if we're talking about an autistic child learning, doing speech pathology, I think we could be talking about an autistic child learning how to speak properly, learning how to communicate. And when I say properly, I mean in terms of using English, which is the language that we use. Long term, they get to school, they're going to go to work, they're going to have friendships, they're going to need to communicate, and they're going to want to communicate their needs. If they don't know how to speak properly, that's going to be really difficult and it's going to limit their potential. So for me, I think we need to be really careful with the neuroaffirming movement. And I am so neuroaffirming. Oh my God, I love it. But sometimes I think people take what they think it is, but that's not what it is. So what neuroaffirming is that it doesn't mean we're just permissive in terms of our parenting. What it does mean is that we understand the why. We understand with emotional regulation strategies. We understand with being safe. And we understand with boundaries, but we don't control or force the child to be into a neurotypical mold. No, we do not. But we absolutely parent with boundaries, safety, and emotional regulation skills. Now, if you'd like to know more about this, I recently went to an amazing workshop with Maggie Dent and also Vanessa LaPointe. I was so pumped to be the MC at that event on the Sunshine Coast. And if you'd like to know more about that, have a look at their work. It is very much, I'm here with my child, but particularly with Vanessa LaPointe, she did a great job of illustrating the leaning in. Let your child lean on you because they are looking for you to show them and to create safety. If they're pushing a boundary, show them where the boundary is because that's what keeps them safe. And it can be very anxiety provoking to not have a boundary as a child, because you're looking for the parent for leadership. So if you have a neurodiverse child, I want to be really clear, neuroaffirming is not that we don't correct, we don't challenge, we don't help our children. That is not what neuroaffirming is, okay? We absolutely have a responsibility to help our children grow to their best potential. And I think one of the great things about neurodiversity being genetic is that the parents are often neurodiverse, and so they get it. Often they've masked before. They understand it. So that can really help some of this confusing aspects around being neuroaffirming. If you'd like to look at some research, I can pop this into the show notes. Dr. Mona Delahook, I looked her up. She emphasizes co-regulation and neurobiology before behavior modification. So she talks more around neurodiverse kids need scaffolded support. It's not like sink or swim parenting. It's like, I'm just going to scaffold you. So if we look at, you know, the pool learning to swim, you know, back a long, long time ago, people used to just throw a child into the deep end and be like, oh, well, let's just see how they go and have a beer. That's not scaffolded support. Obviously, scaffolded support is like teaching them in, you know, really shallow water, showing them the strokes, letting them swim to you a little bit of the way, building skills, asking how they felt, waiting till they're ready. That is more around the neuroaffirming movement around neurodiverse children and parenting. It is not about letting them do whatever they want, whenever they feel like it, because they're perfect. I don't even know how you do that if you have multiple children, because if you let everybody do anything that they wanted all of the time, it would just be chaos. Like, it would just be chaos. So the key takeaway here is, we are still allowed to guide our neurodiverse children and be neuroaffirming. We're doing it in a firm, kind, and fair way that honors the child's nervous system, their communication style, and their brain wiring. We are not crushing it into submission. which is the old traditional, more form of way of parenting. Myth number 7. If you do not love being a mum all of the time, then you are doing it wrong. This is such a ridiculous myth. Like, if you don't love being a mum all of the time, you are doing it wrong or you're a bad mum. We actually know this myth. We know that this is not true, but yet it is embedded into motherhood culture and it just barely gets questioned. Have you noticed that? And some things that grate me a lot is cherish the time. It'll be over too quick. You should be feeling grateful for when your child's a baby. You know, when they grow up, you'll miss them. Cherish these days. You wish you had been differently. Get off your phone. All of these, like, being present in the moment, enjoying it, hashtag blessed. Blessed to be your mum. I get that. I am grateful. I am blessed. There's times that I don't feel blessed too. And some weeks it's easier to feel those feelings and some weeks it's hard. Having this myth that you are supposed to be feeling that all the time creates a lot of these issues, I would say, with being a mum in this day and age. Because if you're not feeling those feelings, then what? Do you feel guilty? Shame? You can't talk to anybody because it's like taboo. You may start feeling like something wrong with you. Your self-esteem, you might still start feeling depressed or anxious. Or from this myth that isn't true. Neurodivergent mums are more likely, I think, to experience parenting burnout, emotional flooding, sensory overload, and just feeling dissatisfied. Not because we love our kids less, but because this type of parenting and this type of mum life in this day and age was never designed to accommodate our brains. 100%, it just wasn't. In 2022, there was a study from the Journal of ADHD and Emotional Regulation, and it found that ADHD mums scored higher in measures of parental burnout, particularly if you have multiple children. So if you're not feeling the love and the gratitude of every moment, you are not broken, you are overloaded, okay? I don't know of any mum who feels grateful and blessed every minute of every day. I just don't think that's true. Okay, let's wrap this up. The key takeaways for this episode is high functioning, high masking equals high risk of burnout. That is not the goal. Executive dysfunction is not just about getting things done. Kids who cope well at school might be suffering silently. The goal is not to fit in. The goal is to thrive on your own terms. I hope you've enjoyed this ADHD myth busting episode. If you have any more myths, please jump into the Facebook group and post there and say what myth you loved or what myth you would love covered. Check out the show notes. All of the research is going to be there. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode.